This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at Apple, at Google, at Spotify, at Reason, you know, wherever you get your podcasts, and rate and review us while you're out and about in podcast world. Some of you will remember the fictional memoir written by the late, great Jerome Tichilli about his misadventures in the late 1960s and early 1970s libertarian movement. It was titled, It Usually Begins with Ayn Rand, because especially back then, it was actually the case that most of the time, libertarians had originally been drawn to individualism, a belief in free markets, and other ideas after exposure to the novels and essays of Ayn Rand, the Russian-born writer. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, Capitalism, The Unknown Ideal launched a million libertarians, more than a million libertarians, as well as that more doctrinaire group of Rand believers who are known as objectivists. That's her name for her philosophy. My guest today is very much of a Randian, and he's unapologetic about his love of capitalism, as was Rand. Jonathan Honig is the founding member of a hedge fund called Capitalist Pig, and he's a contributor on Fox News as well, regularly appearing on shows such as Bulls and Bears, Cashing In Your World with Neil Cavuto. He's also the editor of a new book called A New Textbook of Americanism, The Politics of Ayn Rand, which completes a series of articles that Rand started in the late 40s but never finished. Honig, along with a roster of people mostly associated with the Ayn Rand Institute, including Leonard Peikoff, Amy Peikoff, Yaron Brook, and Andrew Bernstein, just to name a few of the contributors, have laid out a collection of essays that they hope will revive interest not just in Rand's ideas, but in a broader concept of Americanism. John, thanks for talking to Reason.
My great pleasure.
So let's start by defining Americanism, because that's part of what Rand, in a series of essays that she started but then didn't complete, was kind of sketching out what Americanism is. What is Americanism?
Yeah, I mean, it's a concept that is probably, Nick, even more hotly debated now than when Rand first started this project back in 1946, as you said. She started a series of articles, Textbook of Americanism, which was designed to educate, you know, the everyday layman, not the philosopher or the college professor necessarily, about just what the concepts behind this country are. And it's very much up for grabs today as it was now. I mean, there's a sense now, Nick, of, you know, America is, you know, whatever we feel like, whatever we vote on, it's anything. But, you know, Rand understood that America really was the first country in the world founded on a basic principle of individualism. That's what America is about at its very core, at its very founding. That's its DNA, if you will, founded on these ideas, not on a geographic location, not on a race or class or anything else, the basic principle of individualism. So she starts there, you know, not with a series of, well, what are going to be the politics of this country? What are the rules and rights of this country? She starts her essay, and the book starts with asking this very essential question: what is the basic issue in the world today? What are politics? Where do they start? They start with this fundamental question: is this a society of individualism, or is this a society of collectivism? And America is a society and as a country based on individualism that made it very unique in its founding, and still makes it extraordinarily unique today.
So talk a little bit about that. Individualism, you know, what does that mean in a Randian context, or the way that you talk about it in the various essays in the book? And we're going to talk about some of the specific chapters, but what is collectivism versus individualism? Where does that battle line get drawn?
Well, I mean, Rand obviously talks about it in great detail, but, you know, collectivism, big picture, is this notion that it's the group that matters. You know, Nick, it's the collective. However, you know, you want to define it at the time, it's the group that is value, the group that matters, the group that has power, if you will, in a society. You know, individualism is very much the opposite. Individualism is the idea, is the doctrine that says it is the individual that matters. His own life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, that's the standard on which everything can and should be judged in a society. Is it good for the individual? And, you know, Rand famously talks about how, you know, any group is only a collection of individuals. You know, her big picture philosophy is based on this notion of individual rights. And America was the first country in the history of the world, Nick, that put the individual first and foremost. You know, it is your life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. It's not the king or the Fuhrer or the greater good or the country first. You know, this was the country that said it's the individual's life that matters. And the purpose of government, the only purpose of government, is to protect that each individual's right to his and her own life. So it's a tremendous topic, obviously explored in great detail in the book. But this very unique notion, still to America, what Americanism really is that, you know, it's your life. You matter in this country, not the greater good, not sacrifice to any other entity. And that's a pretty powerful topic, especially in the realm of politics.
Yeah, you know, in the late 40s, there were certain collectives that were obvious or had just been defeated. You know, the idea of you know, the kind of Nazi master race as a group against, you know, that subjugated individuals, exterminated them. You know, what are the collectives now that the collective identities that you think are particularly ascendant and problematic from a individualist point of view?
I think, Nick, that's what makes A New Textbook of Americanism so important, especially right now. I mean, the project's been in the works for a number of years, but, you know, there are really no voices, as I can see it, no consistent voices for individualism. My God, certainly in American politics, and hardly any in America. There are really no voices putting forth that the individual is what matters. Collectivism is everywhere, Nick. It's certainly on the left. I mean, that's like kind of de rigueur now. We understand that, you know, the leftists, however you want to define it, it's sacrificed to, you know, it's Obama's "I am my brother's keeper." You know, there's a very obvious, or even something as seemingly benign as the environmental movement. You know, it's the collective, you know, collective sacrifice for the environment. But Nick, what really worries me is that whatever we use to define the right, and I don't actually believe in these notions anymore. I think it's individual, as Rand alluded to, it's individualism and everything else. And the right, I believe, Nick, is very much in the mode of collectivism now. I mean, America First is collectivism. And in fact, the book talks, not at great lengths, but it touches on it, talks about how this notion of nationalism is collectivism. It's sacrifice to the nation. It's saying, well, the nation is the standard of value, not me as an individual. So the right is very much as collectivist as the left now. And that's what makes thinking as an individual and promoting individualism, that's the radical idea in America today.
Talk about the, you know, immigration comes up a little bit in the book, and I think it's in a section that is authored by Leonard Peikoff. What is a Randian perspective on immigration? Because that seems to be one of the places, excuse me, that the right and particularly conservatives are very bothered by the idea of immigration.
Sure. Well, I mean, immigration is, you know, Nick, and you're a regular on the TV circuit as well, and I don't know if you'd agree with this, but, you know, my experience, there's always been more passionate topic than immigration. In the about 20 years, I've been doing national TV and interviews, and this is a topic that really brings out tremendous emotion and energy among everyone. And there's a lot of debate, even within objectivism. And Ayn Rand didn't write too explicitly about her views in particular on immigration and immigration policy. And there's a lot of debate about what the right policy should be. But I think in general, and what we do know from what Ayn Rand wrote, and certainly what Dr. Brooke wrote, is that we know that immigrants are a tremendous value. Ayn Rand herself, of course, was an immigrant to this country, and that, you know, immigrants refresh the American spirit. Immigrants bring great new skills, great new opportunities. Immigrants enhance the economy. Oftentimes what I find, and people who have an objection to immigrants, it's really more, Nick, an objection to, let's say, the entitlement state. You know, they're not angry about immigrants, they're angry about immigrants, you know, using the entitlement state. So oftentimes it's a secondary objection. So, you know, I think most objectivists, and certainly the book presents immigrants to be a value to this country. What the particular policy should be, what type of screening, if screening, that's certainly up for debate. You know, but this idea is for, you know, this book and this, Rand's perspective is the big picture philosophy that individualism is the basis of American.
Was it Yarnbrook who was talking about immigration then, as opposed to Peikoff in the book?
I believe so.
One of the things that was kind of asserted there too, which struck a chord with me though, and is interesting in Rand's thought in general, is that. But she's also not doing a cost-benefit analysis, right? She's not saying, well, immigrants are okay because on net they produce more than they consume. How does that illuminate a kind of basic insight into Randian thought that's a little bit different than a lot of fellow travelers in a kind of libertarian world?
I think that's – thank you for bringing that up, Nick, because it's exactly right. I mean, oftentimes, you hear a topic of immigration, gun control, and exactly right. I mean, some libertarians and almost probably everyone else in politics say, like, well, let's weigh that out. How does this benefit the nation net? Well, the nation, quote, needs these types of workers, so maybe it's good. Or the nation doesn't need these types of immigrants. So, and even you'll hear the president talk about, well, we need certain types of workers. I believe Rand would put forth, that's actually a very collectivist idea. What does the nation need? The nation needs freedom. The nation needs individualism. And, what any one particular employee a company needs or wants to hire, that's a particular individual choice. So this whole notion, Nick, that, the nation requires this or that, I think that's exactly the collectivism I believe that is very antithetical to America. Well, there's an essay in the book, for example, another one that's pretty hotly contested written by Harry Binswanger, Dr. Harry Binswanger, where he puts forth that this idea of buy American. And that's even a lot of libertarians, Nick, I believe, would say, oh, of course, you want to support America. You've got to buy American. Ayn Rand and we put forth that I believe that, buy American is actually very un-American. This tribal notion that, boy, if you love the country, you have to buy the Hershey bar and not the Toblerone, as I've said a few times. America is about individualism, Nick. If you want to buy, foreign clothing, foreign goods, knock yourself out. That's the freedom. That's the individual that truly defines America, not this tribal notion that you
where
buy
is,
goods.
Where is, and Buy America, projects are certainly bipartisan. Donald Trump talks about that. Barack Obama, as part of the stimulus, put in money saying, certain types of steel and whatnot in stimulus projects had to be American steel. Is that the sign of a declining nation, or is it, where is that impulse to say, now, we gotta buy locally, we gotta buy from people who look like us or vote like us? Where is that coming from?
It is collectivism for sure. It's tribalism. I think it's actually oftentimes very much racism, but it's also ignorance, Nick. I think about what makes this country strong and great, and that is, of course, capitalism. This notion of freedom, of free trade, of economic power. Forget even the practicality of capitalism. The knowledge that, Nick, if we save money, if Americans can save money by buying a foreign car or a foreign tomato or a foreign avocado or anything else, that money is then saved and reinvested into new wealth, into new projects. So there's an economic ignorance there, but there's also just a philosophical ignorance. This notion that America is about pursuing your own self-interest. That Nick, we're not born in this country with this debt. Debt to your neighbor, debt to the country, debt to the greater good. And this country is about my God, we only have so many years on this earth. Right. We're so fortunate to be born here in America. And it's not about, sacrifice to the greater good and saying, well, I really want the imported jeans or the BMW, but gee, I got to do what's good for the country. So I guess I should go buy a Ford. That's a load of crap, Nick. Mm-hmm. America says, hey, you're free. Pursue your self-interest. Pursue your happiness. That's what this country is about.
What is the role of charity and then the welfare state in your new textbook of Americanism? How does that play out?
Thank you for asking. Yeah, I mean, that's that's addressed in particular. Don Watkins writes, you know, Ayn Rand asked the question, and Don Watkins answers, look, can charity be a right? Do you have a right to charity in this country? And it's an idea that's pretty popular on both sides of the idea of the aisle now, you know, Nick, that, you know, certainly the left believes that charity is on the right, but even look at President Trump's stimulus with the farmers, the payments out to the farmers to compensate for his you know, the trade war, the effects of the trade war. I think there's really a belief in America that, look, what Americanism about is helping your neighbors, making sure that no one should not have health insurance. Everyone should have their pre-existing conditions protected in America. That's what America is all about. So Don Watkins asks and answers, I think, very succinctly that, of course, charity is not a right in America. It's not a part of the American system. And the entitlement state very much the same, you know, Nick. You know,
but is it bad to do charity for people?
It's certainly not bad to do charity if it's a value to you. But, you know, Ayn Rand did not believe that charity was a really major value. Charity was that something that had to be first and foremost in every decision that you make as an individual, and that you know charity is not the most giving back to others. Nick, is I believe, and I believe Ayn Rand would put forth, and certainly Don puts forth, that charity is not the most important thing in the world. The most important thing is pursuing your happiness, pursuing your self interest, not at others' detriment. You know, not by exploiting them or stealing with them, but of course, charity is important if and when you want to find those entities and individuals that you want to help. But, if, you know, now, you know, Nick, charity is at the center of almost every American decision in Washington. Forget you as an individual in Washington. You know, healthcare, trade policy, it's all about, you know, we've got to help our neighbor. So charity is not part of the founding documents, I think, for a very good reason. It's an individual choice. For your own happiness, not giving back to the greater good.
So one of the essays written by Richard Salzman asked the question, how are fortunes made in a capitalist system? What's the answer to that? And, you know, have we lost sight of that basic answer?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, and if you want to make money, I mean, this, you know, Rand talks about America as being the place where the idea of to make money was created, was invented, right? I mean, before America, if you wanted, who was rich? Well, it was the aristocracy, Nick. It was the kings or those who had the financial pull. And, you know, in America, who has become billionaires? People who have, you know, it's these creative minds, these in a free economy who've created something, the Sam Waltons, the Andrew Carnegies, the Michael Dells and the Bill Gates who've created these tremendous enterprises, companies that have improved all of our lives in a huge way. So, yes, Richard Salzman talks about fortunes being how fortunes made under capitalism. They're made by creation, by production, not by redistribution. He talks about that, you know, America is the capitalist country, Nick, by definition. And, you know, what do we have now? Even among those on the right, celebrating these great producers, but saying, oh, well, you know, Jeff Bezos, he's out to get us. And, you know, well, we really need to see if we.
Yeah. Are you worried at all? I mean, on the right, particularly when it comes to tech giants who are ascendant, you know, people like Bezos, companies like Apple and whatnot. But particularly the social media people get a lot of guff from the right. I'm thinking of people like Ted Cruz and a couple of other Republican elected officials who say, you know what, you guys are screwing conservatives. You're not bringing our points of view to a wide enough audience. So we should be treating you like a public utility. Are you bothered by
tremendous.
That?
Tremendous. I mean, I'm horrified by it. It really kind of gets back to this idea of, you know, who's out there in politics protecting the producer. You know, Rand wrote a book, wrote an essay, Nick, I know, I'm sure you've heard of it, you know, about big business is America's number one persecuted minority. It's very much the case. I mean, 2018 saw this ugly spectacle of these great great innovators, Mark Zuckerberg et al. Being, you know, given these show trials on Capitol Hill, you know, Nick, interrogating them about why aren't you giving more hits or likes or up arrows or whatever it is to conservative causes. Laissez-faire, hands off. This is a you know, in fact, it's discussed in the book and in the new textbook of Americanism, the difference, Nick, between economic and political power. Rand wrote about this throughout her career and started it in a new textbook of Americanism, the understanding between economic and political power. Economic power is what Facebook has, is what Apple has earned. They've earned it, Nick. It's the power to trade. You know, all Facebook can do is put forth a trade. You want to use the system? Use it. If you don't want to use it, use something else.
Do you worry at all about I agree with you on you know, on that concern, but do you worry that companies like Facebook or platforms like Facebook, like Google and, you know, YouTube and whatnot, that they are pretty shoddy with the way that they treat, say, our privacy or our data or our information, that there's stuff going on that we don't really know about? Does that concern you, or do you think that that's mostly a kind of bad critique to try and get people's hooks into, you know, getting the businesses to do what they want?
Well, you know, if you look at a lot of surveys, I don't put too much value in surveys, but, you know, Nick, oftentimes people say they're more concerned about these issues, claim to be more concerned about issues in terms of internet privacy than they actually are. So I have to say I am not concerned about it. I think that, you know, Facebook, Twitter et al. They have created social media. These are the companies that created it. And we as consumers in this context have a choice. We can either participate or not, share certain types of information or not. And what we're seeing, Nick, in fact, is that the market freedom works. You know, you're seeing types of voices get deplatformed. Companies saying, look, I don't want Alex Jones on my site. I think that's a positive thing. They need to set those standards and set those objective criteria of just who is going to be allowed, what types of speech is going to be allowed, and what types of speech is not. And Nick, new platforms will be created. I mean, we remember when MySpace was the thing and didn't keep up. So no, in a free economy, there is, especially when it comes to speech, this notion of, well, government has to step in to protect freedom of speech by regulating social media companies. Boy, Nick, if that's what we get to, I think it's sending us down a real, real, and I was disappointed with Senator Cruz. I've been disappointed for him for a long time, but real disappointed. Both parties are embracing regulation of social media companies. It's very anti-American in my view.
Elon Jurno contributes a chapter that asks or answers the question, what should a distinctively American foreign policy do? Now, this is a place where traditionally I think a lot of objectivists and libertarians kind of part company a little bit. How does the book answer that question? What is a distinctively American foreign policy?
Well, government has a real important role. And this is great debates in libertarian circles, I know, in anarchist circles, Nick, about, you know, what is the proper role of government? And Journal answers, and I believe answers, Ayn Rand answers, that the government is our agent of self-defense. That's what it is. That's its essential role, is securing our freedom to pursue our goals. And just as police and courts are essential, we need an effective military force to protect our freedom through foreign threats. And that's a big part of the proper role of government, is to eliminate and neutralize and defang foreign threats to our country.
So does that military, I mean, I guess in the objectivist world, as opposed to the libertarian world, you know, and again, these are kind of like overlapping, but distinct circles, where does that leave us, say, vis-a-vis year 18 in Afghanistan or being in Iraq? Are these, from a Randian perspective, were these mistakes or were they righteous operations that went wrong, or are they actually still righteous operations?
Well, I'll let Alan's work speak for itself. But my belief, and I think a lot of objectivism would put forth, Nick, that, you know, that militant Islam in militant Islam is a threat to this country. But building schools to kind of use that old tired catchphrase that I think is really true, you know, building schools or helping the Muslim people or bringing democracy to the Middle East is not the proper way to protect American interests in the Middle East or anywhere else in the world. That the idea of a American government is to eliminate the threat to us, eliminate the threat to Americans, and then truly, yes, come home. So in a proper American, self-interested American foreign policy starts with eliminating the threat by force, eliminating forces of Americans by force, and then leaving it to others to build democracy, to create schools, to build the roads. That's not American. That's not America. Right. The American military's role.
Is that something that has changed? And I realize, you know, we're talking about Rand and then Randian inspired people and things like that. But, you know, the difference between, say, right after World War II and the Cold War and now, it seems that because Rand was more militant. I mean, she was certainly anti-communist, and she believed in taking the fight to communist countries, right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, she was explicitly anti-communist, explicitly anti-collectivist. And a foreign policy journal writes, Nick, a foreign policy is one that embraces this notion of individual rights, and the idea that, look, if there are threats to this country, if there's enemies to this country, then it's absolutely proper to eliminate those threats, eliminate them resoundingly, and that's only by pursuing or eliminating these enemies can every American be free to pursue his or her own self-interest. And that's exactly what Rand believed, what Journeau talks about in detail.
Was she in favor of the Vietnam War?
Well, she was against the Vietnam War, Nick, and actually writes not in the book, but writes in pretty detail about her feelings on the Vietnam War. Yes, absolutely.
Well, let's turn to one of the chapters that you yourself contributed, which explains why there should be no death tax or no estate tax. What's your basic argument there?
Well, it's Rand asked the question, would it pay us to divide great fortunes? And I answer it, you know, pretty resoundingly that, you know, even the question Rand asked, you know, would it help us? Like, there is an us in America. Mm-hmm. No, America is a land of individualism. And I ask in the book, you know, Nick, look, if you give your wristwatch to your kid, if you have a wristwatch, you give it to your kid, you know, does government step in and say, well, wait a minute, half of that wristwatch or a third of that wristwatch belongs to us? You know, it's the greater good. It's the people really are the ones that earn that. Absolutely not. So, yes, Rand, I believe, was very much against the death tax, the estate tax. It is not moral to divide great fortunes or anyone's fortune. And, you know, Nick, you might say, well, that's been settled. But, you know, look at to quickly tally back to the feelings towards some of the great wealth creators today. Jeff Bezos, as you said, Warren Buffett, many others. You know, there's a sense that they didn't earn it. You know, it really would be better invested in other purposes. So, no, the death tax, the estate tax is completely un-American. Any efforts to redistribute wealth for the so-called greater good, I think, are anathema, Nick, to American principles.
What do you think about, you know, a tradition of people? You mentioned Andrew Carnegie before, but also John D. Rockefeller, Warren Buffett, Bill Gates. These are all people who either gave away large parts of their fortune or are planning to. Warren Buffett talks a lot about, you know, he's taking care of his kids, but, you know, most of his money is being given away. How do you feel about that? I mean, obviously, it's their money; they can do what they want. But is that a wise choice on their part, do you think?
As you said, I mean, they can do whatever they want, but I think it's a real ugly development. And Gates is probably the biggest example of this. I mean, you know, Bill Gates, when he was at Microsoft, Yaron Brook has talked and written at great lengths about this. I mean, Bill Gates was oftentimes seen as a villain. You know, I mean, he was the monopolist, you know, at Microsoft. His Windows was taking over everything. And in fact, Bill Gates had the antitrust, the Justice Department on his case in antitrust. But, you know, when did he become a real hero? When he started giving his money away with the Gates Foundation, and he started this promise. What do they call themselves? The billionaires who promised to give away all their money before they die. Mm-hmm. I think it's pretty ugly, you know, Nick, in my opinion, if you say these billionaires who for some reason feel tainted by their wealth, feel like, you know, when I'm earning it, I'm a bad person. I'm exploitative. I'm evil. But boy, if I'm giving it away, that's what makes me a hero. And you see it oftentimes with the Walton family, you know, the Walton family with Bernie Sanders and others, that, you know, have this terrible animosity towards businesses and individuals and their families who've been able to create wealth and then don't feel as if it's incumbent on them to spend the latter half of their life giving it away to anyone who asks. So, no, I don't think that sort of a passion about giving away every cent that you earn is I don't think it's very becoming. I'd much rather see these producers invest, start new companies, start new businesses, new enterprises. And, you know, it's the difference between someone like Steve Jobs and Mother Teresa. You know, Mother Teresa is she's a saint, right? And how would we make Steve Jobs a saint? Well, not by making Apple. We didn't make him a saint, made him a billionaire, but made him a saint in my eyes. But, you know, if he had given it all away, Nick, if he had sold his yachts, if he had put himself up on a cross and said, take it all, well, then he would have been a saint. But, you know, you're a saint for earning money.
Harry, you know, that raises a point that I'm interested in pursuing with you. There's a chapter, an essay by Leonard Peikoff, I believe, that argues that capitalism is ultimately secular. I'm thinking, you know, Reason celebrated its 50th anniversary this year, and I talked to a bunch of our early editors and whatnot, and Bob Poole, you know, who created Reason Foundation in 1978 and was an early editor, said that coming out of the 60s, that the difference between conservatives and libertarians, and Reason was started by a guy who was a devotee of Rand, and a lot of the early libertarian people were Randians. But Bob said, you know, the real difference was that the libertarians tended to not be religious. You know, not just capitalism secular, is libertarianism or objectivism, you know, ultimately secular?
Well, certainly objectivism is completely secular. And America, I believe, is secular. You know, the founders were, yes, they were Christians, but they were, as Dr. Peikoff writes, Nick, you know, they were deists. They believed that, you know, here on earth, if you will, God, to borrow a line from Kennedy, you know, God's work, what must really be our own. And capitalism requires this wall of separation between church and state, just as it does between economy and state. And, you know, the government doesn't establish religion or any ideology, nor does it redistribute wealth or regulate the aspect of the economy based on what the church necessarily would believe. So, yes, I do hold forth, and Dr. Peikoff certainly holds forth, that America is secular. It's not based on this, you know, we always hear, Nick, that, well, America is based on Judeo-Christian ideology. Well, no, it's not. A new textbook of Americanism, I think, explains really in great detail how it's individualist ideology. It's not this notion of God is great and everything that the country is about seeing his will done. America is a secular country. It's a country based.
Do you feel like is America, you know, and obviously you spend a lot of time on Fox News, you know, when you're not trading, you're on Fox a lot, which tends to pay a lot of lip service to religion. Do you think the country's getting more secular over time? I mean, most of the polls show, you know, that, you know, baby boomers are less religious than their parents were. Gen Xers are less religious than baby boomers, and millennials are less religious than Gen Xers. I mean, do you get a sense of that, or do you think that's not quite right?
I think, and this is my opinion here, Nick, you know, I think that they've mm-hmm. moved their sacrifice from God to what they believe is that, you know, is God's messengers here on Earth. Some of them in politics. So I'm happy to see that the country is getting less religious, but I think ultimately it's for naught, because we're getting even more collectivist. So we're getting even more self-sacrificial. People are, so it's, they don't care about sacrificing for God anymore, Nick, but you know, for their neighbor or for the environment or for the greater good, that hasn't been challenged at all. So I,
one of the stark differences, I think, and I'm thinking about this partly because of the, you know, the dividing line between secular culture and religious culture and whatnot. Rand was very much in favor of abortion, unapologetically in favor of abortion. That is something that nobody seems, you know, very few people are unapologetically for abortion anymore. Where is the moral claim in objectivism or that Rand draws? And I assume you agree, you know, that abortion is, you know, is a right, you know, that a woman has a right to, you know, control her body and that there's nothing to be, you know, kind of squeamish about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not written about in a new textbook of Americanism, but, you know, Rand was absolutely pro-abortion. And this, the notion that, you know, rights are, you know, though she goes, we do talk about rights in detail, that, you know, rights belong, Nick, to human beings, and that an embryo, a fetus is not a human being. It's inside of a mother. It's a part of that mother, and it's the mother who has the right to her life and her body, and that every decision made regarding her body is up to the mother. And that, so I actually believe that, you know, pro-life,
and that's all the way through until birth.
Well, this notion of, you know, third trimester abortions, mm-hmm. I mean, they are so rare to begin with, Nick. I think you have to search very difficult, you know, it's very, it's a very awful procedure for any doctor to perform. I think that's why you have to, mm-hmm. you know, most abortions are done very early in the pregnancy.
Right.
I think it's, but absolutely. I mean, I think life begins for me, and this is my perspective here, although I believe Dr. Peikoff would echo me when saying, you know, life starts at birth. That's when life begins. Yeah. And any effort to, you know, put government's hand inside of a person's body to say, no, this is what you can and cannot do with your body before that umbilical cord is cut, I think is a terrible, terrible violation.
It's amazing how she, you know, that was one of her big knocks on Ronald Reagan, and it was that he had, as governor of California, had signed into law, had helped legalize abortion. But then when he ran for president, very much was anti-abortion, although he ultimately didn't actually do much about it. But
absolutely right. It's actually right.
Let me ask you, you know, one of the other things that the new textbook of Americanism, you know, kind of raised for me, and I say this as somebody who, you know, I'm familiar with Rand's work, but not super detail. She's not an anarchist. A lot of people now, you know, who are libertarian, seem to be anarchists. You know, and they say, you know, all, you know, government is bad. More government is more bad. But and taxation is theft. I understand why estate taxes, you would consider that theft because this is the proceeds of somebody's life and it's already been taxed at various times. But where was Rand on things like, you know, the general taxes you say to support a military in the proper scope of her? Like what was her position vis-a-vis taxation?
Well, you know, Rand believed in objectivism believes that government is not a necessary evil. You know, government is a necessary good. Government is a real positive. It's essential for capitalism, but just the right type of government. You know, Nick, a government whose only mm-hmm. purpose, whose sole purpose, is to protect each individual's right to his and her own life. So you're right. I mean, anarchism is I don't know if it's getting more popular or having a revival in popularity, or I don't have a great sense of that, but objectivism is completely against anarchism. This, you know, idea of competing, you know, governments. How do you have a competition in force? I mean, that's the biggest gun wins. No, we Ayn Rand believed that we actually have to have a government, the right kind of government, quote, small government. Okay. But limited government, a government whose proper role is truly limited to the protection of each individual rights. And, you know, if you follow that, you know, Nick, so much of what we think of as being inseparable to government now just simply goes away. You know, everything about education, you know, everything about housing, Everything about transportation simply goes away, and government's true.
But taxes being levied in order to pay for those necessary functions, that's, you know, there's no problem there.
Well, Rand had it's not talked about in the book, but Rand had a number of very innovative ideas about taxation, voluntary taxation, in fact, and that all taxes should be voluntary. And she put forth a couple of great ideas, I think, Nick, about a lottery, for example, or, you know, but even something as, you know, but seemingly benign as a consumption tax, mm-hmm. You know, would be any step ahead of this just mess of progressive redistribution and wealth hatred and wealth confiscation that now is the tax system. But, you know, the truth is, Nick, that a proper government is so small that, you know, we're talking about a tiny amount of money relative to what is taken today. So
was there a moment in American history where the government was actually the right size? Because, you know, when you go back to the founding, obviously the federal government certainly was a lot smaller, but, you know, there was also slavery that was being enforced. Local governments oftentimes, you know, were controlling, you know, what people could wear, you know, when stores could be open, et cetera. So, you know, there's always been a lot of government in people's lives and a lot of regulation. But, you know, when you say that, like, if we got to the proper size of government, a lot of the questions that we have would just be kind of moot, because, you know, we'd be talking about rounding errors in our pocket change and whatnot. But has there ever been a time like that?
I think what's changed, Nick, is that now we're so much more accepting of it. You know, when something like, you know, that when the income tax came along, you know, there was great outrage and debate about, you know, how terrible is one example. But, you know, now, today we're just so accustomed to this idea that, of course, we pay taxes and the rich should pay more. The more you earn, the more you should pay. And, you know, this idea that, you know, taxation is not theft, that, you know, taxation is a good thing. And depending on, you know, if you literally love the country, you should pay more and more taxes, and that government can do whatever he wants. And why not shouldn't government run the schools? And why not should government, you know, build the roads? So, you know, government has been a lot smaller, Nick, historically. It needs to be a lot smaller in every way, because, as you said, I mean, now there's just this notion of, you know, taxation is just part of America. And, you know, we can debate it, but it needs, and it doesn't need to be the way it is now. And I think that's something that's very positive that people are putting forth, that look, it's my money, I earned it, and that it's government's role not to come in and take it away, but to protect me from it. So
what is your kind of origin story? How did you, you consider yourself an objectivist? How did you get into objectivism? And, you know, also, what do you say is the main fault line between libertarianism and objectivism?
Sure. Well, I studied philosophy in college, Nick, at Northwestern, and it left me hating the world and hating man. And it's around that time someone said to me, look, you really should pick up Ayn Rand. And I did. And thankfully, I did. Starting in college, and I really started devouring her work. And it's improved my...
What did you start with?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, Nick, a textbook of Americanism was one of the first pieces of Ayn Rand that I actually read, because I grew up in the 80s and particularly in the early 1980s, Nick, and I always loved this country. I knew that I loved this country. And, you know, that's what I think, makes Rand so important, is that she really is the American philosopher. Ayn Rand is the, you know, you said she was a Russian, you know, the Russian novelist, and like,
yeah.
Russian born. She hated Russia. She couldn't wait to get the hell out of Russia. Never to return. She threw off everything of, you know, she is the American voice. She is the American philosopher. So the more and more I read about Ayn Rand, read her work, I really more and more understood that and embraced that. And that's part of what I think is so important about a new textbook of Americanism, is to reinforce that fact that, you know, Rand is not this 20th century figure that, you know, had something to say about free markets. You know, she is the American voice, the American idea, and the American philosopher, which is why everyone on both sides of the aisle, I think, or wherever you sit in the political spectrum, will find great value in a new textbook of Americans.
Do you feel like, does she actually convince people to change their minds, or is it more that you recognize yourself in her work? And it kind of articulates what you already feel? Because, you know, one of the interesting questions, and this is true of any kind of political or ideological orientation, and, you know, whether it's objectivism or libertarianism or progressivism, you know, trying to get people to get bigger numbers. Do you feel like she convinces people, or she kind of awakens in people something that they already believe?
The former. Dr. Brook, for example, was a card-carrying socialist in Israel before he read Ayn Rand. And you hear it over and over again. And it is cliche, Nick. People say, I read Ayn Rand and it changed my life. And that's still the case. And I think that's what makes the new textbook of Americanism so great. This is a short, easily accessible work. As you said, it's a series of essays, most of them just a couple hundred, maybe 1,000, 1,200 words that really pack a huge radical punch. And especially for young people, you know, who are really starting to discover. I mean, you know, Nick, truly, by the time you get to be 30, 35, you've made up your idea, you've made up your mind, you've solidified your philosophy. But, you know, these ideas pack a huge major punch. And that's when people are really discovering who they are, you know, 13 through 25, maybe 30. And so, yes, absolutely. I think Ayn Rand changes people's lives, improves people's lives, and doesn't reinforce them, but really has a traumatic impact, and which is why reading her, especially at a young age, I think is a great benefit to anyone, including a lot of people who ultimately went on to libertarianism as well.
Yeah, what do you think is the difference between objectivism and libertarianism? Or is there a neat distinction between them?
Well, Peter Schwartz, actually, another objectivist, has written volumes about this. So, I'll let him speak to it. But my response is that, objectivism, as you correctly put forth, Nick, is a complete philosophy. It is not simply about, politics or in the non-aggression principle. It's a complete philosophy starting from the basics of metaphysics and epistemology all the way through politics and aesthetics and every other aspect of life. So, my understanding of libertarianism is that it's a political doctrine in particular. Objectivism, I think, is much bigger, much more. It's about it's a true, complete philosophy, and which is why I think a lot of people who come to libertarianism because they don't really know what objectivism is. They've kind of never heard of it, but ultimately find great value in discovering objectivism and seeing how Ayn Rand's ideas are really a complete response, and not just about the politics.
So are you optimistic about the future? I'm thinking of, I probably catch you a couple of times when I'm channel surfing and watching cable news. I see you, talking on Fox. And, you're one of the few people on Fox that calls out Trump when he, starts doing boneheaded stuff about, say, immigration or trade in particular, because you're on a lot of investment shows and things like that. But do you think that Trump is the future, or the Democratic socialists, who seem to be gaining ground in the Democratic Party? Are they the future? Optimistic, pessimistic? Why or why not?
Well, Nick, prosperity is not guaranteed. We had a dark ages for many, many years. So, I'm hopeful for the future. And I tell you, if this country is saved, it's going to be the ideas in a new textbook of Americanism. It is going to be individualism that saves it. I don't believe that the Democrats, certainly I don't believe that Donald Trump reflect or espouse individualism, Americanism. So I am hopeful for the future, Nick, because I see and talk to a lot of young people who are questioning authority or questioning collectivism and picking up Ayn Rand en masse. So I'm very hopeful for the future, but it's not guaranteed. And I think people really have to kind of think and take ideas seriously You know, if the next 100 years of Americanism is going to be as bright as the past.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Thank you so much. We've been talking with Jonathan Honig. He is the editor of a new book that is called A New Textbook of Americanism, The Politics of Ayn Rand, which completes a series of essays that Ayn Rand began in 1946 with the help of half a dozen or more contributors. John, thanks so much. Where is the best place for people to find your stuff online?
Sure. Well, the book can be found at textbookofamericanism.com, and I'm at capitalistpig.com. Thank you again for having me, Nick.
All right. Very good. This has been The Reason Podcast. I have been your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at Apple, at Google, at Spotify, at Reason, wherever you go, and rate and review us while you're there. Thanks for listening.